Good morning.
I'm going to call the meeting for the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. The first order of business would be to approve the minutes from January 26th. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and yes, I will move the minutes from January the 26th.
Thank you. The minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Well, you are part of history here today. My understanding is that for the first time before the legislature, we have the Minnesota Records Disposition Panel before us. I'm looking forward to this discussion. I'm sorry?
Oh, no.
No? Oh, you know what? We should have, we forgot to include that in the memo to them. Yeah. So with that, I look forward to hearing from these folks, and I understand that there are two testifiers, David Kelleher and Sean Rounds. So please come to the testifiers table. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
And go ahead with your testimony. If you'd just introduce yourselves for the tape and go ahead.
Right. My name is Sean Rounds, and I'm with the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm the state archivist.
Madam Chair, David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society.
Great. Thank you very much for inviting us today. I appreciate the chance to talk with you. I've prepared some short remarks, and then, of course, we'll be very happy to take questions on this topic. I've come here today to talk with you about the administrative processes of the Records Disposition Panel. In my capacity as State Archivist, I oversee the work of the State Archives at the Historical Society, which is charged with identifying, collecting, and preserving the historical government records of the state from all levels of government. And this is a function that we've been carrying on since 1945. And by necessity, it brings us into contact with records management activities. By statute, my position also functions as the secretary to the panel, a role that in practice is fulfilled by State Archives staff. So to begin with today, I'd like to set the context for the work of the panel by talking about briefly about the statutory framework for records management in the state. Minnesota Statute 1517 is the Official Records Act, and specifies, and I'm going to paraphrase here because if you've read it, you know it's lengthy, that public officers and agencies, quote, shall make and preserve all records necessary to a full and accurate knowledge of their activities. And it goes on to say that the chief administrative officer of each public agency is responsible for the records that are made or received pursuant to law or in connection with the transaction of public business. The administration of government records is dealt with in 138.17. This statute not only establishes the panel, which I'll talk about in detail in a moment, but it also specifies that each government entity must establish and maintain an active and continuing records management program. And this would include a comprehensive records inventory, as well as a records retention schedule that establishes retention periods and means of disposal. And here I'm just going to say that instead of repeating government entity many times today, I'm just going to shorthand that to agency. And so just know that when I say that today, I mean it as it is in 1517, to refer to any unit of government at any level. So a retention schedule is basically an inventory of records by record types that explains how a record should be managed over time. At a minimum, the schedules not only list record types, they also specify the minimum amount of time that a record needs to be kept, and that's called the retention period, as well as what happens to it at the end of the retention period, which is known as the disposition of the record. Retention periods are based on legal, fiscal, administrative, and historical value or requirements. Disposition generally takes one of three forms: dispose or destroy, retain in the agency, or transfer to the state archives. So, for example, A schedule might list something like property maintenance records, keep 3 years, then discard, or city council minutes, permanent, retain in office. You might have something like cash receipts, keep 3 years or until audit, then destroy, or governing board minutes, retain 5 years and then transfer to the state archives. When putting together retention schedules, many agencies follow records management best practices and schedule records by content, not by format or media. This means, for instance, that the same retention period and disposition applies to the entire record series, no matter what the format it is. So, for instance, those property maintenance records, if we use that as an example, will all be receive the same retention and disposal, whether they're paper or digital, or whether they're in a file cabinet or on a server or on a DVD somewhere. They all get managed in the same fashion. So agencies can create their own schedules. I will mention that there are also model ones called general retention schedules that are pre-approved, and we're going to come back to those in a minute. So it's important to note here that there is no central records management authority in the state. There's no one coordinating or overseeing these agency processes. It's not the job of the state archives, and it's really not anyone's job currently. Statutes set the responsibility for records management and scheduling very firmly with the agencies themselves. So it's at this point only that the records disposition panel really comes into the process. The panel as it currently stands is defined by 138.17 to include the Attorney General, the Legislative Auditor for State Records, who is here today, the State Auditor for Local Records, and the Director of the Minnesota Historical Society. The statute gives the panel the authority to direct the reproduction, storage, and disposal of government records, which it does through the review and approval process. 138.17 directs the agencies to submit their retention schedules to the panel for approval. Disposal of records without that approval from the panel is prohibited. It's the unanimous approval of the panel on a schedule that gives the agency the ongoing authority to dispose of records. So generally, the panel doesn't meet in person. Instead, the review and approval process takes place through a routing function that's facilitated by the State Archives staff. So the panel process goes like this. Agencies create their own schedules. They submit it to the State Archives. State Archives staff log that schedule. We track all these things very carefully. That's part of what we do. And then we review the schedule for records of historical value on behalf of the Historical Society Director. And here's where I need to explain that each panel member has appointed a designee to work in their stead on this routine review work on the schedules. So keeping that in mind. Once the State Archives has finished its review, the schedule is sent to the Attorney General's designee, who will look at it for legal considerations. After it's finished in that office, it then moves to either the Legislative Auditor's Office or the State Auditor, depending on whether it's a state or local schedule. And there it's reviewed for fiscal considerations. At the end of this process, the schedule is returned back to the State Archives. If the schedule has been unanimously approved, we keep a copy for the permanent files of the panel, and we return a copy back to the submitter as their authority to act. However, if any of the panel members have requested a change, that's communicated back to the submitter, who is then expected to update the schedule and resubmit it for another round of review. In any given year, the panel generally reviews upwards, or receives, I should say, upwards of 100 schedules, and that's state and local. In fiscal 16, there were 136 of them submitted to the panel. There are two exceptions to this review and approval process. The first involves those model or general schedules that I mentioned. If an agency doesn't want to create their own schedule, they can adopt a general schedule if one exists for their type of government body. These schedules cover retention and disposal for common record types for any government body. They are pre-approved by the panel, and if an agency wants to adopt one, they submit a notice of adoption to the State Archives, And once that's signed off on, they're good to go for using that schedule. One benefit of this is that it provides consistency of management of these record types across a type of government. Schedules like these exist for cities, counties, county or local registrars, townships, school districts, the Minnesota District Courts, and Volunteer Firefighters Relief Association. There are also state agency general schedules for finance, human resources, and property management areas. The second exception to the scheduling process is when an agency wishes to dispose of their records. These records are generally no longer created, and they may not even be on a retention schedule. Sometimes an agency will literally find records as they're cleaning their offices and say, oh my gosh, what do we do with these? We need to get rid of them. And they can then apply for what's called a one-time authority to dispose of records. They submit that application with all the details about the record type, and that gets routed through the panel, and it requires unanimous sign-off as well. This is not a substitute for a retention schedule. This is just an administrative process for records that are defunct and no longer needed. One example that comes to mind that sometimes we see in the state archives is a local government will be cleaning house and they will find, say, wolf bounty records or something like that. And they no longer need them. They want to transfer them to the state archives. They don't want to have to schedule them just to take them off the schedule and transfer them, so they will submit one of these PR1 forms, as they're called. So as I've said, the State Archives is the point of contact for the panel, and we oversee the administrative functions and serve as its secretary. By statute, all the panel records are public. Records from 2003 to the present are available in the State Archives offices during business hours. People can come in and see them, and they do. Records from 1947 through 2003 are actually part of the State Archives permanent collection, and those are available through the Historical Society's library. The State Archives also maintains a website for the panel, which offers links to the relevant statutes, details on the processes, and sort of an FAQ for agencies and the public to understand how schedules work, and then contact information for each of the panel designees. And the URLs for both the panel and the State Archives are on the handout I think you have on the statutes. So I'd like to close by just once again saying that the State Archives is not the records management authority for the state, and neither is the panel really. The central records management function was once filled by the Department of Administration, but that was removed from statute in 2006. And the panel does not have a monitoring or enforcement role or mechanism. Since there is no central office, agencies are really largely autonomous for how they fulfill their records management responsibilities. If government staff have questions about records management, the State Archives provides some general assistance where we can and where it's appropriate by phone and email and online. The State Archives does not, however, ever provide recommendations or directives on specific record types. We don't have that expertise, nor do we have the authority to do that. So these sorts of questions get referred back to agency records managers or legal counsel. So I would just say that if there is a reinstatement of central records management authority or expansion of the panel functions, that would, of course, carry costs as well as benefits. So I'm going to close with that, and thank you for your time, and we're happy to take questions.
Thank you. Member questions?
I have a few. Okay, first of all, let Representative Bugo. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your excellent presentation. I'm wondering if there has ever been an audit to, or maybe a review is a better word, of the various agencies, since they're each autonomous. Sounds like they're autonomous in determining what they're going to keep and for how long and whatnot, just to identify best practices.
Mm-hmm. I will say that I have been state archivist for only 5 years, I'm not aware of any sort of survey that has been done like that. We do see when schedules are submitted, they are reviewed by you know the three different panel members that look at them. But I don't believe that there has ever been any sort of comprehensive look across agencies. There have been times when the state archives will talk to a panel about the process of scheduling, but again, the specialized knowledge about what their records are and the requirements for that, really that responsibility does lie with the agency.
Representative Hugh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. So I have one other question with regard to a concern that might surface. I don't know who it would be that would surface a concern about the lack of records that had been retained, and you know, have there been those kinds of inquiries, concerns expressed? To whom are they conveyed, and who might weigh in? Who has weighed in about maybe what should be done or what could be done?
Right, Madam Chair, the we do get questions about schedules from the public, and as I said, the panel's records are public. And people do come in and look at them. When it comes to questions about what should be kept for how long and that sort of thing, the state archives can only speak to the historical records on a schedule. The other records on the schedule, we would defer to members of the panel because we can't speak to the decisions that they make. And if there are questions about a schedule, we generally try to refer those to the panel members, either the particular panel member if there's a question about, say, financial records, or to the panel in general.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hugh?
Thank you.
Ms. Rounds, if it's a state agency, from my understanding, then it's the legislative auditor's office that would be the one fielding any questions about those issues. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, yes, that is correct.
Okay.
As I said, the Attorney General will look at records for the legal value. So state agencies are reviewed at the Attorney General's office as well for those. The legislative auditor will look at state records for fiscal considerations.
Okay. And Ms. Rounds, how often do you evaluate retention schedule guidelines that you set out? Because you have, like, model guidelines, right, for these agencies to look at. How often do you evaluate that?
That's correct. There are model guidelines, these general schedules. This is a difficult question. They are not reviewed on a regular basis. To be perfectly honest, no one has responsibility for those schedules since the Department of Admin went out of the records management business. The Department of Administration at one time had an office that, as I said, coordinated records management, and it was largely through that office that the general schedules were set up some years ago. Once that office and the Department of Administration was removed from statute, there was no other mechanism put into place to review or update those schedules. Now, that said, I have to give kudos to professional organizations for stepping in and filling this gap. So, for instance, the Minnesota MCFOA, I think it is, steps in and is responsible for the City General Records Retention Schedule. They will update it. I think the last update to that schedule that was approved is 2013. So these professional organizations like the Minnesota Association of Townships or the City Group will take responsibility for these general schedules and update them. Those updates, once they're completed, are submitted to the panel, and it goes through the review process again in approval.
So that raises another question or two or three. So why in 2006 was it removed from statute that the Department of Administration should oversee this?
I was not part of that, Madam Chair.
Okay.
But I understand it was for monetary considerations. But I really can't speak definitively on that. I'm sorry.
Okay. I see Ms. Christensen is here. Is she willing to take the chair on this one? She was
I don't know if she was with the department or not in 2006. I'm guessing not. She's so young, she probably was still in high school or junior high maybe at that time. But welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Stacey Christensen with the Department of Administration, and I literally started at the department in 2006, so I'm not that young. The simple answer to that question is the funding went away in 2003, and then it was removed from statute in 2006.
Right.
So it was just a financial consideration.
And I'm guessing, do you have any idea what it was costing at that point?
Madam Chair,
no.
I'm sorry.
Okay. We're going to check into some of that, because I think this is troubling, that there's really, that each agency is just kind of policing itself. And you know, and I don't know, Ms. Rounds, if you want to address this, but if they, you know, they introduce these schedules to you for approval, mm-hmm. and then they're kind of just on their own, and there's no way to know whether they're abiding by their own schedule. Is that right?
That's correct. There is no oversight or compliance component anywhere within the functions of the state government.
Right. And does your panel, I was looking through the online booklet that's the recommended.
Oh, yes.
What do you call that?
Preserving and Disposing of Government Records.
Yes, that catchy little title. So I was just browsing through that, and I didn't see anything specifically addressing email retention. Has that been anything that you folks have dealt with?
Email retention raises the it goes to that topic, Madam Chair, of that I raised about scheduling by content, not by format. In the last 20 years, there has been this movement to get away from media or format-based schedules. So email is addressed in retention schedules under the category of correspondence.
Okay.
That's generally how it is looked at. So that's been the practice is to schedule it in that fashion. Now, some older schedules and some agencies do schedule email and digital records separately. But I don't know how many do it that way. I think, in fact, most of them, and I believe the general schedules, are mostly format neutral. So the assumption is that, for instance, with the city schedule, that email is included in that correspondence category for management and retention.
And if you know, what's the data retention time currently for correspondence?
It varies from agency to agency and schedule to schedule. And I'm sorry, I don't have the specifics with me today.
Sure. Those... do you have hard copies of those booklets, or is it strictly online in PDF form?
Right now, it's only online.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then early in the discussion, you mentioned that you'd use the term agency to refer to all units of government. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to confirm that that also includes then counties, cities. All of them are applicable to these retention schedules, and in particular, the requirement to send you for review and approval, mm-hmm. what the retention schedule will be.
Yes, that is
Ms. Rounds.
Okay. And, thank you, Madam Chair. And then another clarification. So in regards to the questioning that just happened in terms of emails being considered correspondence, would it also then be true other correspondence? Because then I totally understand the mm-hmm. wanting to govern content rather than mechanisms.
Yes.
But would it be true then that the newer mechanisms such as instant messaging, text messaging, any other means, social media in its various forms, if it is official government business, and I'm looking for how it's termed here, official record or...
Ms. Rounds?
Want to make sure that would be included in the term correspondence.
Ms. Rounds?
Right. I believe it would. My personal opinion as state archivist would be that it would be included into that category as well. And you are right that anything, faxes, texts, even perhaps voicemails, could be considered government records and should be managed as such. Now, how those are categorized by any particular agency is up to that agency, how they are scheduled and managed. And, again, I can't speak to the particulars because there are so many that we're talking about. In fact, just with local government units, there are over 4,000 of them, I guess, in the state. So that's a lot of schedules.
Representative Lucero.
And then on that note of how they're managed, it's up to each unit how they're managed, unit of government. But I just want to rectify, they still have to seek approval by your board in order to determine how long they're going to retain.
Ms. Rounds?
That is correct. And as I said, agencies are not authorized to dispose of records without a retention schedule that's been unanimously approved by the panel. So if they have records, they should be on a schedule, and that schedule needs to be submitted and approved by the panel.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at some of this information, and I see that there's general correspondence, and there's transitory correspondence, and there's historical correspondence. I see that there's a definition. I found a definition of transitory, but what's the difference, I guess, between general correspondence and historical correspondence? And could something that is general transition into a historical document or historical correspondence? What's the definition there?
Ms. Rounds? Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm not sure what handout you're looking at.
Representative Howe.
It's the overview of records management, and it's on the second page, I guess.
Mr. Ealing, is that your document, the overview of records management? You didn't? Okay. Anybody laying claim to this?
I'm not familiar with this handout.
Yeah, that one is from Mr.
Thank you. Do we know where this came from? Mr. Ealing, you didn't present this document?
No, I sent some notes to the committee, but didn't produce
them.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I guess we printed them out. and the committee has them.
I can answer the question if you care.
Okay. Why don't you take a chair?
Please, thanks. This is just background information for numbers. And well, it could be public, but we didn't.
Mr. Ealing, go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, if you
sure.
would, please.
Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We have an interest in this area, as I've already talked about in the past. To your question, Representative Howe, if you look at the city model retention schedule that's on the MHS website, and this is where I found the information, is that they specify out that there's general correspondence, historical correspondence, and transitory. And that's slightly different than some of the other model retention schedules that are out there. So, for instance, counties don't have those different correspondence categories. Now, as to when those categories can change, because it's content-based, and I'll defer to Ms. Rounds, I think the content would drive when it could transition between those categories.
Yes. I agree with Mr. Ealing.
Okay.
That is exactly correct. And so when there are categories like this, especially with correspondence, where the three is kind of an interesting thing, often there are two categories of correspondence. There's general correspondence or some sort of classification of correspondence, which is to be retained for some period, and then there's transitory correspondence. And transitory correspondence is generally considered to be those let's have lunch sort of things, those things which are not part of a government activity or transaction. But again, how that's interpreted by agency staff and how that is applied, how those records are managed within those categories, that's up to each agency.
Thank you, Mr. Allens. Representative Howell, follow up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So something could be considered general correspondence and transition into historical correspondence, but if it happens after 3 years, it could have been destroyed after 3 years and we lost that history. Is that a fair assumption?
Ms. Rounds?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is possible.
Thank you. Ms. Rounds, does the panel have a mechanism for making sure that each government agency or entity has adopted a schedule?
Madam Chair, no, there is no mechanism for that.
So basically, there could be an agency out there operating without a retention schedule of any kind.
That's correct. The panel has no mechanism for knowing if an agency has a. Let me put it this way. I'm sorry. Let me start again.
Sure.
The state archives tracks every schedule that has been sent to us. We keep the files and we track those submissions, including any general schedule adoptions. However, the panel does not have a way of knowing if an agency has not sent one, and we have never done any sort of, the panel has not initiated any sort of survey of that sort.
Okay. So then I'm guessing that if an agency wants to deviate from the schedule that they already submitted to you, they wouldn't have to come to you and ask for a deviation. They would just do it, or they could just do it. Do you ever get requests for deviations from those schedules that they submitted?
Madam Chair, I think there's two parts there. First of all, if an agency has a schedule and they deviate from it in practice, we don't know about that necessarily unless they choose to say, submit either what's called an amended schedule to us or to say we need that one-time authority to dispose of records if a record series is no longer being created.
And what are your criteria for approving or disapproving a records retention schedule? Do you just go off of the model time periods that you have?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I can only speak to that for the historical value of records, and there we work from past experience. I really can't speak to how the auditors or the Attorney General make their recommendations or their review process themselves. I would have to defer to the panel members for that. I'm sorry.
Thank you. And before I let you go, because I'd like to have the legislative auditor come up and answer some of those questions if he's prepared to do that. Perfect. Do you have within the panel, because we've talked a lot about correspondence here, do you have a definition that you use for correspondence?
Madam Chair, no, the panel has not established, I don't believe, a single definition of correspondence. Again, each agency sets their own expectations for what is included in that category.
Thank you. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This comes up because I'm remembering some of the comments from Representative Lesh in the past, but I would have to assume that these retention schedules then apply to a contractor that's working for a government agency as well as an employee or the agency itself.
Is that a question to...
I'll let that out there. I don't care who answers it, but I'm assuming that, and I'm looking at myself as a government contractor, that the emails that I receive about different items, if I'm working under the guise of a government contract, would fall under that same retention schedule, but how would that then transfer into the government agency? Who keeps it? Who transfers it? How is it applied?
Well, it should apply, but Mr. Ealing, you stepped up to the mic. What say you?
Would you like to answer?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Generally, in cases like that, and again, I'm speaking only my own opinion here as state archivist, I would think that you would have anything that the agency receives would be part of their records. We do see things like project files on schedules, for instance, and so it may be possible that such things are included in there, but I would guess that it would vary by agency as to how that practice is handled.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Ealing, did you have anything to add to that?
The only thing I would add, I completely agree. The only thing I would add is that access to those files is governed by the Data Practices Act, and the legislature clarified a couple of years ago and reaffirmed what they had passed in 1999, that contractors with government entities performing government functions, their data is accessible to the public under the Data Practices Act. I also, in my, you know, I do this up as a volunteer up here. I do some work for the University of Minnesota in my professional life. So, for instance, the work that I do for the U of M is all available under the Data Practices Act.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I would just point out the government function component of that, right? So if your contract is doing a service that the government would otherwise perform, then it is. But to the extent there's a component of it that is not, or other lines of your business that are not, I would argue that, that it wouldn't impact that. I don't know if Mr. Ealing has a comment on that.
Mr. Ealing?
The government function definition is, I think that's something that's out there for future litigation to decide. And it could be one of those areas that needs further clarification in the future. How that is defined.
Representative Lesh, follow up.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm always a fan of more litigation since I am a lawyer. And anything we can do to increase that is great. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you, Ms. Rounds. I appreciate you being here. It's been very informative. And please stick around in case there are other questions that arise, if you would. Wouldn't mind doing that.
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Nobles, are you available? Mr. Nobles, if you could go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, that would be terrific. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and I really appreciate being here with you today on this topic. And, Madam Chair, thank you for raising this issue. It may seem like you're deep into the bureaucracies of government, but that's where transactions and important decisions are made. And this is not just about bureaucracy and paperwork. This is about transparency and accountability. And we know that when we go into organizations to audit, you audit because you want to know what those decisions were based on, whether they were legal, how they were made, the criteria that were followed, and those need to be recorded. And so what you will find in some of our audit reports is a criticism of agencies for a lack of documentation. They have not followed the Official Government Records Act. And I think that's one of the most important principles and laws that this legislature has enacted for accountability and transparency. Now, have we ever done, going to your question, Madam Chair, a comprehensive survey of compliance with that? No, but when we go in and we're looking at a particular activity within a particular department, let's take one that was just raised. Let's say an agency had a contract, a $100,000 contract. We would definitely want to look at all of the documentation, the RFP, the criteria that were used for making a decision to hire that contractor. We would want to see the invoices that were used for reimbursement to that contractor. Were they within what was agreed to? So documentation is incredibly important in government if we really are going to have transparency and accountability. And it's something also that we practice in the Office of the Legislative Auditor. When I orient new staff and tell them about the criteria that we follow, the standards that we expect of them as auditors, there's one slide that says document, document, document. And in fact, for every one of our audits, evaluations, we have what are called work papers, and they're required by audit standards. So every sentence that you see in one of our audit reports has to have a source document in our work papers that accurately represents the facts as we determine them to be. So again, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about our work, how we approach our responsibility on the panel. But I do just commend you for getting into this issue because it is incredibly important if we are going to have transparency and accountability in government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Representative O'Neill. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Auditor, for being here. It's fantastic. When I worked in the private sector for nonprofit, I actually, for many years, worked with audit teams and audited things, and I would go over to foreign countries, actually, and go right back to the source documents, and so I appreciate you explaining that and how important that is for an audit trail. You have to go back to the original receipts, the original correspondences, look at their policies, their procedures, do they actually follow them? So my question is, what happens to an agency when they destroy documents that they should have retained and you're impeded in your audit of what they're doing? What actually happens? What, maybe you've given an example of what actually has happened to an agency or the procedure of what happens after that fact.
Mr. Nobles.
Well, our authority is to cite them from noncompliance, but we would certainly expect that they would implement the recommendation that we would make, and oftentimes we would go back in to make sure that they've done that. We work with the Department of Management and Budget tracking implementation of our recommendations. So there should be a change of policy if we cite them for a lack of documentation. We actually will cite them for a lack of not creating the record to begin with, though, not just destroying or, in fact, we are currently conducting an investigation that we will be releasing next week where we cite an organization for lack of complying with state law for creating an official government record.
Representative O'Neill?
So well, we've all read your amazing audit reports, and I know that we sometimes take legislative action based on those things. I've created legislation based on your recommendations. But as far as anything punitive to an agency, is there any mechanism by which there's actually punitive action taken for, you know, maybe egregious actions of not retaining records or destroying records or not creating records where they should have, or, you know, it almost gets, well, I'll leave it at that.
Well, Madam Chair and members, if the destruction of the record was attached to some sort of criminal activity, and sometimes that may actually occur, we would certainly refer that to a county attorney or in some cases refer that to a U.S. attorney. And that has actually been part of our investigations and indictments of people for what would essentially become obstruction of justice. Another thing we do, if we go into an organization and we find a lack of documentation and we think that there is some issue, again, some concern about the use of public resources, and there is a lack of documentation, we will bring the responsible people into our office and put them under oath and interrogate them or interview them about what occurred. If they didn't create documentation, we will, in a sense, create the documentation through an under oath interview.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nobles, thank you for coming down today. So based on the conversation this morning and based on your own experience in this area, I want to summarize three areas that I've, based on the conversation that I've heard of, that there are areas or opportunities for potential change, and then I wanted to see if I missed any based on your experience, if you could add to this list. So I've heard that agencies may not have a broad enough definition for correspondence, so there may be official government business occurring that they may not consider records that need to be retained, such as internal instant messaging or other mechanisms. For those agencies that do submit a retention schedule for approval, there isn't an enforcement mechanism to ensure the agencies are abiding by the retention schedule that they've submitted to be approved. And then the third would be, there are agencies that haven't submitted for approval retention schedules, and there isn't an enforcement mechanism to ensure that agencies are submitting retention schedules. Is that those three, and are there any additional?
Madam Chair, representatives, I think those are the ones that I've heard. But I would say that there is always the possibility for the Office of the Legislative Auditor to follow up on the concerns that you've expressed here today. And we could certainly do a survey, a review, an evaluation, an investigation, whatever you want to call it, of all of the agencies to determine whether or not they have established a retention schedule. Again, as was explained, we only know of the ones we get. We don't know of the ones we don't get. But there are ways we can find out whether or not they have, in fact, established retention schedules, and we could review them all. That could certainly be a comprehensive review that we could conduct.
Representative Lucero? I think she mentioned 4,000 entities. That would take a while. But
Our jurisdiction, Madam Chair, would be just for the state agencies,
yes, right,
but that's
right,
a pretty heavy lift in and of itself.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I don't have any idea how many just of those there would be. But thank you, Representative Lucero, because that was going to be my next question. As you know, we've learned today that there are these, basically unaccountable. These agencies are unaccountable, in a large part for their retention schedules, even submitting them and having one, let alone abiding by their own retention schedule. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but since you're here, the issue of this correspondence and email and those sorts of things, because of the functions of your office in fact-finding, do you have any recommendations on the length of time that email should be kept?
Madam Chair, I think for us as an audit organization, we would expect people to keep emails that relate to an official activity according to the same schedule that's kept for any other kind of documentation related to that.
Okay.
So if it's 5 years or 7 years, it should become a part of that official record. Now, I think we all know that in today's world, we get a lot of email about a lot of things, and we send a lot of emails about a lot of things. And some of it is just like, could we get together for lunch? And so when we talk about email as a category of retention, we're talking about a lot of documents that, frankly, wouldn't relate to any sort of an official function. So if it relates to an official function, it should be retained by the same schedule as any other kind of document related to that function. That is certainly the practice we follow in the Office of the Legislative Auditor. If I send an email to a commissioner asking about something that we're investigating or auditing, that email would go into our official work papers and be retained if I had sent, just as if I had sent it on paper or if we had done an interview. It's documentation that should be retained.
Thank you. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm getting the idea that we don't have an answer to this, or if there is an answer, it's nobody, but I'm just looking at this where it says key statutes, and it talks about Minnesota Statute 138.225, the prohibition against unauthorized disposal of records penalty, and it sets a misdemeanor penalty. But are we saying that there's no one charged with the enforcement of that statute? I would have to believe that statute assigns someone to enforce it. It normally does. But it seems kind of counter. There's a lot of our stuff that is a toothless line that doesn't set a penalty, but here there's an actual penalty. So who's in charge of going after and enforcing it?
Thank you. Mr. Nobles, do you have an answer for that?
Madam Chair, representatives, the law requires the legislative auditor, whenever we find, and it specifically says the misuse of public resources, so it doesn't specifically cite destruction of records, but I think we could certainly incorporate that in and refer a finding related to the inappropriate, unlawful destruction of records to a county attorney. And they would make that would be the county attorney's choice whether to bring charges or not.
Okay.
We have, it's a little off of what you're talking about, but it's relevant to your general concern here about government records, and that is we have had a increasing concern about the internal misuse of government records within agencies. You all know, I think, about the state employee who was inappropriately viewing driver's license records. And that was referred to the county attorney, and he was prosecuted and found guilty. So there are those opportunities for people to be prosecuted for misuse of records in a variety of ways.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nobles, so a couple minutes ago you said an email that says let's get together for lunch may not be critical, but I can think of tons of times where it might be critical. For instance, if I had sent an email to the chair of the stadium commission to get together to talk about an issue, but I said let's get together for lunch, and then an issue came up as part of the sports facility commission, that would be an email I believe that should be available. So I think it's real, you know, if it's my neighbor down the block that I don't have any interest here at the Capitol, I can understand that. But I think we need to be clear that some of these on the surface may seem really sort of not a big deal. But who knows, on down the road 6 months or a year later, that might be a critical piece of evidence and something that might be investigated.
And Representative Dean, I think the guideline there, and I think it's in statute, if it has to do with any of your official duties, then it has to remain part of the public record. But I'll let Mr. Nobles answer that.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I would agree that if this lunch was of great significance, let me not even modify it. If it's related to a business function, then I think a person might well retain it. And we would want to see. Oftentimes we are, in fact, in investigations creating timelines of events, and those would be helpful. It simply has been my experience in some reviews or investigations that we've done that we have obtained all the emails. And one of the ways we collect emails for an investigation is that we don't go to the person who initiated the emails. We go inside the email server system and extract all the emails and then have to have a process of searching for those that we think are significant.
Mr. Nobles, when you've done that, are you finding that the emails are still there, or have they been deleted in some way, or is it a mixed bag?
Madam Chair, it is mixed, and there is now, you know, in the state of Minnesota, we use a company, Microsoft email system, and so there are certain protocols that are followed by the vendor, but also by the agencies for whether or not emails are ultimately destroyed or not. And it gets pretty complicated, but we in our office, for example, require people to actively retain certain emails, again, within work papers, because of the protocols that after a certain period of time, if you don't actively save them, they will ultimately be destroyed under some email systems. And it's my understanding that the email system that Minute provides to state agencies does have an automatic destruction mechanism within it. It's probably a 6 months or so kind of ultimate destruction. You might want, Madam Chair, to talk to Minute about that. Okay. What are the protocols within the state's email system for destruction? It tends to be a two-step process. You can, for example, go into your email if you have a Microsoft email system and delete an email, but it will be retained within Microsoft for an additional period of time and could be extracted, but that is not an indefinite period of time.
And do you know, Mr. Nobles, if Minute is using cloud storage as well, and so would there be a difference in whether it was held on a Microsoft, on a server versus the cloud? Do you happen to know?
Yes, Madam Chair. It is a cloud-based system, and that is why, for that reason, because of the protocols that exist at Microsoft, but also for certain security reasons, that we download important emails onto our servers and retain them. Otherwise, again, they wouldn't be retained.
Have you found in any of your work where you're trying to get some data from the cloud, how easy is it to do that? How complicated or easy?
Madam Chair, we have gone directly to Minute and done that. We have not had to go directly to Microsoft, but we've worked with Minute, and they have been cooperative. You know, it's a little bit of a delicate situation for them because they consider the email the property of the agency and not of Minute. And therefore, they have said that access into their system to obtain email has to be approved by the agency. We have said, not for us, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, because we have access to all data regardless of classification. And so we've obtained that.
And so has it, what's the time frame? I know it probably depends on what you're asking for and stuff, but have you found it fairly timely that they're able to retrieve the data that you're after?
Madam Chair, it can be complicated. Again, it depends on what kind of email. Is it based on a person? Is it based on a subject? Is it based on a certain time period? Or all of the above? I mean, if you go and ask Minute to extract out of the Department of Human Services all email related to a certain topic for for a long period of time, I mean, you're going to be getting probably millions of emails. So the more specific you can be as to the subject, the people, and the time period, the more effective, cost-effective your request is going to be.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Nobles.
You.
I greatly appreciate it. Any other member questions on this topic in general? Any comments? I think it's been really informative. I thank all of our testifiers for being here this morning and for the jobs that they do. And I'd like to see, like Representative Howe, I'd like to see some teeth put into some of this and some accountability, certainly. And it seems like Representative Ogle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and as we move ahead on this, I think we also have to consider if there's going to be penalties, that, yes, there are some things that are intended.
Correct.
But there are also things that are inadvertent. Mm-hmm. And in regulated business, it doesn't seem to matter whether it's intended when it comes to fines and penalties and so forth. So however we do this, I think we have to look at if there's going to be penalties, that, first of all, that we recognize whether it's intended or inadvertent, it still occurred. And then, secondly, to have some type of an audit system,
right?
Because without that, again, we're really saying to private industry, you have to do this, and if you don't do it, we're going to come in and fine you. But then us ourselves as the regulators or whatever, we don't check on ourselves.
Right.
I think it, mm-hmm. So we have to be careful as we do things to make sure that we're being consistent with those that we're governing.
Nice words. Thank you. With that, members, thank you for your interest in this, and we are adjourned.